Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Thank you for this tremendous turnout on such a chilly Denver evening. Susan Cain's writing has been widely published. In periodicals, her work has appeared in such places as the New York Times and The Atlantic, and online at time.com and psychologytoday.com. She has spoken at Microsoft, Google, the U.S. Treasury, and at TED 2012. Since her TED Talk was posted online, it has been viewed more than 3 million times. Her book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, was a bestseller on lists from the New York Times to the Tattered Cover. It is currently being translated into 30 languages. We are delighted that Susan finally has the opportunity to visit us here in Denver at the Tattered Cover to present the new edition of Quiet. Would you please join me now in making her feel welcome?
Well, first of all, thank you all so much. So many of you who have come out on an evening like this. I'm honored and touched, and I thank you. And I also want to say, before I get started, that there are probably some of you with whom I have been communicating over the last year through social media. But since I have a 13-inch laptop and I'm looking at you through a thumbnail photograph, I'm probably not going to recognize you when we meet at the book signing. So please, please, please introduce yourselves. I would love to actually meet you formally in person. So I'm going to give a little talk and then open things up for a Q&A. And I'm going to start by just sharing a little story. And for those of you who have been with me over the last year of this quiet revolution, you might know a little bit of this to start with. I want to start by speaking to you about how it is that I came to be launching a quiet revolution in the first place, and what it was in my personal history that led me to do this. And I thought I would start by telling you just a quick story of something that happened to me when I was 9 years old and went to summer camp for the first time. And our camp counselor at camp gathered us around, and she said that she was going to teach us a cheer, which we would then recite for the rest of the summer. And the cheer went like this. It went, R-O-W-D-I-E, that's the way we spell rowdy, 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 let's get rowdy. So I couldn't figure out for the life of me why we had to be so rowdy all the time, or why we had to spell this word incorrectly. But you know, I think that there are two kinds of responses to this kind of situation, and one of them is to recite the cheer along with everybody else. It's a kind of self-preserving instinct. And the other is to really hang fast bravely to your own way of doing things and then stay silent. And I was a self-preserving kind of kid. So I recited the cheer, but I was wondering all along what exactly I was doing. And I had that kind of wondering, in a way, for the rest of my life as I found myself in situation after situation that called on me to be more rowdy, more extroverted than I truly was. And I spent, I think, a lot of time and a lot of energy, in trying to live up to what I call this extrovert ideal. And I've come to believe that this is a real mistake. It's a mistake for me, but it's also a mistake for the many introverts in the population who I think do the same thing. And in a way, that's really what I'm here to talk to you about today, is a mistake, a grand mistake, or really three grand mistakes that I think we all make. And one of them is that introverts make up a third to a half of the population. So really, a third to a half. And I know this seems surprising, but that's because all these introverts are going around acting like extroverts. But it's a third to a half. It's one out of every two or three people you know, maybe you, maybe the person sitting next to you right now, or your spouse, or your child, or your colleague, or your classmate. And we're not making the most of these people's hearts and minds. Mistake number two, we are living with a value system that I call the new groupthink, which holds that creativity and productivity emerge from an oddly gregarious place. And mistake number three, we believe, perhaps unconsciously, but we do believe it, that the most assertive talkers have the best ideas. And so I know you have recently found yourselves gathered together in some meeting or other and watched as people listen to and then follow the opinions of the most assertive member of the group. That person might at that moment have had the best ideas. They may not have. There's zero correlation between these two things. And that's a real problem when you think about important decisions that we make in groups, like jury trials and important decisions in innovation and so on. Let's talk a little bit more, in a little bit more depth and seriousness, about what it means to be an introvert. And I'm going to give you a quiz. This quiz is adapted from my book, which has in it a longer quiz than the one we're about to do. The quiz in my book is based on the years that I spent researching this topic. But I'm now going to give you just a quick six-question true or false quiz. And the more you tend to answer true to the following questions, the more introverted you probably are. You don't need a pen or paper. You can just kind of think about it as we go through. Okay. So quiz. Do you tend to prefer one-on-one conversations to group activities? Number two, do you feel as if you enjoy work? Do you enjoy work that allows you to go in depth with few interruptions? Number three, do you feel as if you do your best work on your own? And number four, and this is a biggie, do you tend to think before you speak? Because this, of course, is one of the big differences between introverts and extroverts. Introverts tend to think at length, ad nauseum, before they want to articulate their thoughts. Extroverts tend to think out loud. And so when you get introverts and extroverts together in a meeting, for example, the result can often be total mutual incomprehension. Because you have the extroverts quite understandably feeling baffled and maybe annoyed at their introverted colleagues, because they're saying, you know, I know this person is brimming with ideas. I know they have so much to contribute, and yet they're refusing to do so. They're sitting here mutely instead of contributing to the larger good. Why is this? And the introverts, meanwhile, are feeling as if by the time they think of the thing they wanted to say, the meeting is over. So that's a problem. It's worth thinking through, and we will. But, you know, the first place to begin, of course, is with a kind of mutual awareness of where each side is coming from. Okay, number five. Do you feel as if you dislike small talk, but find almost miraculously that when you're among kindred spirits or speaking about a subject that you really, really care about, that you start to act like more of an extrovert, perhaps? And then finally, number six, I'd like you to imagine that, okay, you've gotten to the end. For those of you listening in by podcast, imagine you've been at a party for about 2 hours. You've been having a good time. You've been talking to people you really like. You've been dancing. You've been having fun. Still, at the end of 2 hours, for most introverts, will come the time that they start to wish to dear God that they're home in their pajamas. Whereas extrovert, you know, because introverts, they recharge their batteries by being on their own. So they might be having a fantastic time at the party. They might be the most socially skilled of human beings. But still, their battery is kind of running down by the end of the party. And now they need to go home and deplete it. Whereas extroverts feel revved up and charged up by all this social activity. So they are looking for more at that point. Okay, so how many of you, having run through this very quick list of characteristics, how many of you would describe yourselves as introverts? Okay, it can't possibly be 100%. So let's do it the other way. How many of you are extroverts? Okay, we've got a nice, brave handful. Thank you, extroverts, for being here. And let me say, there's also a term in psychology, ambivert, for the kind of person who truly feels they are smack in the middle of the introvert-extrovert spectrum. And also, I should say, even for those of you who really do feel you're very far along one end of the spectrum or the other, you know, even Carl Jung, the psychologist who first popularized these terms, said there's no such thing as a pure introvert or a pure extrovert. He said such a man would be in a lunatic asylum. So this explains for why we are all kind of a glorious mishmash at the end of the day. But now that I've thrown this concept out of ambiverts who really are smack in the middle, how many of you feel as if you answer to this description? Okay, a good handful of you. I'm going to say that was maybe 10%. Okay, so let's talk about kind of the course of introverts and extroverts through life. And I'm going to start with children. What you're looking at here is a picture of a Mommy and Me music class, which is the kind of class that toddlers often attend, accompanied by a caregiver or a parent. And, you know, basically you sit around in a circle and sing songs and play musical instruments and like that. And it appears to be an innocuous toddler activity. But if you enter such a room as an anthropologist or a psychologist, you actually notice a web of incredibly complex social dynamics. What you see really are mini introverts and mini extroverts. And you see some of the children who are sitting closely, cleaving to their parents' or caregivers' laps, the more introverted children. And then you see other kids, like that little guy in the red jumpsuit in the middle of the circle who has no idea where his mom is. And that's perfectly okay with him. And there you have it, except you have much more than that. What you often also have are the parents, in particular, of the introverted children who are silently worrying at this very moment that their young child is not getting as much out of this music class as the freer-seeming, bolder-seeming, roaming-around, more extroverted children, and that perhaps this is going to be the story of this young child's life. Maybe as they go through life, they're always going to get less out of it than the bolder or more gregarious children around them. But what's really going on for these quieter children, they're not sitting inertly on their parents' laps. They are sitting and very subtly, very quietly, very intently taking in everything that's going on. And ultimately, they will participate. For some, it takes minutes, for some days, for some weeks, or even months. But when they do, they often come to social dynamics with a very subtle understanding of what happens there. So they're not sitting inertly, they're sitting intently, they're taking things in subtly. And you can see this when you give, this is a kind of cognitive approach to life. So when you give introverted and extroverted children this kind of a puzzle that you're looking at here, where you have two pictures that look very similar to each other, and the object is to discern the subtle differences between the two, what you find is that the introverted children spend more time and give more care to piecing out those subtle differences. And in the lab, you can even track their eyes going back and darting back and forth more frequently between the two pictures than the eyes of the more extroverted children. This is an orientation to life. It's an orientation of taking things in a subtle way and processing it in a complex way, which is part of what leads these children, when they grow up, to take a long time before they speak in meetings, because they're wanting to process everything through in the manner in which to which they've grown accustomed. Now, before we talk about introverted and extroverted grown-ups, which we're about to do, I want to take you back for a minute to the animal. Oops, not back there. Hold on. Back for a minute to the animal kingdom. One of the most amazing things that I discovered in my research is that there are introverts and extroverts in almost every single species of the animal kingdom. I mean, did you know this? I thought this was amazing, all the way down to the level of fruit flies. Like, really, there are fruit flies that biologists call sitter flies, and they kind of sit still in place. And then there are fruit flies that are called the rovers, and they're, you know, exploring the outer margins of fruit fly society. And the reason for this is that these two types of animals within any given species, they have dramatically different approaches to survival. They have different survival strategies. So in some situations, one type survives better, and in certain situations, the other type survives better. So what you're looking at here is a pumpkin seed fish. The biologist, David Sloan Wilson, went to a pond full of these fish, and he did this amazing experiment where he dropped a trap right into the center of the pond, an event which, from the fish's perspective, would have seemed as strange, as alien, as if a spaceship landed here right now. You know, just not something you're expecting to happen. And the fish had radically different reactions to this event. The bolder fish, the more extroverted fish, swam right up to it because they had to know what was going on. They had to explore this novel event in their midst. The more introverted fish hovered judiciously on the side of the pond. So it was the extroverted fish in this situation, it was the extroverted fish who were caught by the biologist, had that trap in a true predator. Those are the fish that would have been eaten. They would have been no more. But, and so it would have been the introverted fish who thrived in such a circumstance. But a few days later, the biologist came back, and this time he was equipped with nets, and he was able to scoop up the introvert fish in his net and carry them back to the lab where they now joined their extroverted brethren. And back in the lab, the tables were turned. It was the extroverted fish who were doing much better because here they were in a new situation, and the introverted fish were totally freaked out by being in new conditions. And we all know this, introverts in the room, 95% of you, you know how you feel when you're in a new place. You just feel kind of out of sorts, right? And it takes you a while to adjust to it. This is one of the hallmarks of being introverted. It's just one of the things introverts often feel. So the fish felt that way too. And they stopped eating and they stopped mating. They stopped doing whatever it is that pumpkin seed fish normally do. Whereas the extroverts were able to just carry on as if nothing untoward had happened to them. So in that situation, the extroverts did better. Now, let's talk about how this all plays out through life for real live human grown-ups. We're going to look first at some famous introverts and then at some famous extroverts. So famous introverts, we're going to start with Albert Einstein, who famously said, "It's not that I'm so smart, it's that I stay with problems longer." And that could be a kind of mantra for introverts, and that's why so many of you are shaking your head or nodding your heads right now. This is the way introverts approach problems. We know this from lab tests of introverts and extroverts doing solving problems. The introverts kind of inspect the problems longer, they stay at them longer, they more often get the right answer, and they do not have higher IQs. They get better grades at university, they've been found to know more about a broad variety of subjects, but again, not smarter. No difference in IQ between introverts and extroverts, but rather the very same behavioral style that gets introverts into trouble in this very extroverted society of ours actually pays off in ways that we don't normally associate with the trait, because we usually think of introversion as just being about how social are you at a cocktail party, when in fact there is much more to it than that, including this propensity to really dig deep and be persistent when faced with problems. J.K. Rowling, in the middle, brought us Harry Potter. That was an incredibly solitary act of creation that produced, a solitary and a careful act, I might add, of creation that produced these books for us. She got the idea for this boy wizard when she was sitting alone in a train, gazing out at a field full of cows, and she was suddenly visited by the idea of this boy wizard, and she knew she had something big, but even then she did not rush home and put pen to paper. She instead spent the next 5 years of her life carefully, intricately, plotting and mapping out the world of this wizard. Things don't get dashed off, and introverts tend not to dash things off, and we all benefit from that. Warren Buffett, self-described introvert, famously cautious investor, when he describes his process as an investor, interestingly, he invokes the image of a solitary artist once again. He describes himself as Michelangelo, lying on his back painting the Sistine Chapel. And he says, "It's my painting, and I'm doing it by myself. And if someone comes along and tells me you need to use more red or more blue in that painting, I tell them to go away because it's my painting." Now, here are some extroverts. And we have Oprah, and we have two United States presidents. And what I would like you to notice about these pictures is how incredibly vivid and dynamic and alive these people seem. Extroverts have what I call champagne bubble personalities. It makes them incredibly delightful to be around. And I think you could see it just looking at their faces here. You feel like they're going to jump off this picture screen and come stand right next to me on the stage. And from the earliest neurobiological research, there seems to be a reason for this lovely characteristic. We know in our brains, each of us in our brain has something called a reward network. And it's your reward network that responds and gets activated when confronted with the prospect of something very appealing, something very attractive. So it could be an attractive person across the room. It could be the prospect of completing a business deal. It could be eating a piece of chocolate. Whatever it is, your reward network gets excited in response to these things. Now, extroverts appear to have stronger reward networks, more easily activated, more highly activated in their brains. Not to say that introverts don't have them also, because they do, and we get excited too. But extroverts are just that much more excitable. And this leads to that kind of seize the day, just do it quality that we know so well and that is so well suited to the culture in which we live. And it is a wonderful quality. I would submit it also needs to be tempered by a, wait a minute, if you do that, X, Y, Z might happen, kind of balancing out, which introverts tend to be better at. Like, if you give introverts and extroverts in the lab games to play where there's the prospect of winning a reward, the introverts, and you throw a warning signal at them saying that all is not as it should be, the introverts will attend to the warning signals, whereas extroverts, when they get excited about a reward coming, they actually literally start blocking the reward signals out of their consciousness and they stop responding to them. It's amazing when you see it. And when you think about all this and what this represents in toto, there's almost no other conclusion beyond the fact that we desperately need each other, right? That the introverts really need the extroverts who are going to get all excited and make and push things forward to happen. And the extroverts really need the introverts to say, let's go through this carefully. Let's do this step by step and deeply, and then we'll get to a good result. And I know I'm giving you, by the way, caricatures to some extent, and I'm sure each of you is feeling, well, I have a little bit of the other way in me. And of course you do, but I'm talking about broad tendencies. Now, this world that I'm calling for, where we each know how to make the most of the other, there are people who do this. They do it instinctively. This is a picture of Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, CEO, and Sheryl Sandberg, the COO. So Mark Zuckerberg, famously introverted guy, brings in Sheryl Sandberg to be his COO, partly because she's just really amazing, but partly because she is an extrovert and she's really good at and enjoys doing the things that he doesn't like to do so much, and vice versa. And so together they are greater than the sum of their parts, and they represent a partnership where each is not intruding on the other's domain. They're just respecting each other and they're all the larger for it. So that's all good. Now, the thing is though, none of this really makes sense until you kind of deep down understand what it is that makes introverts and extroverts differ from each other. And it really boils down to how do we respond to stimulation. So what you have to know is introverts feel at their most alive, at their most energized, at their most charged up when they are in environments where there's less stimulation coming at them. By which I don't mean less intellectual stimulation. I just mean, you know, less hubbub. A bookstore is actually a perfect example. There's all the intellectual stimulation in the world, but it's quiet, it's peaceful, there's just not a lot going on. You're not called in 12 different directions. Extroverts are exactly the opposite. Extroverts crave more stimulation, and when they're not getting enough of it, they feel bored and listless and unhappy. It's a feeling we all know. It's not a good feeling. And This of course translates into social differences. It explains why introverts might prefer to have a glass of wine with a close friend as opposed to going to a big party full of strangers where, you know, that's a very stimulating thing to do. You're navigating all kinds of body language and introductions and witty repartee and everything else you're supposed to do at parties. It's just a lot. But this goes beyond social life. So there was this fascinating experiment by the psychologist Russell Gean. And he gave math experiments to introverts and extroverts to solve with varying levels of background noise. And he found that the introverts did best when the background noise was lower, and the extroverts did best when the background noise was louder. And that's a profound bit of research for those of us who care about the way people think and the way they work and the way they learn and the way they thrive, because what it's telling us is there is no such thing as a one-size-fits-all environment. It just does not exist. And if we want to set up our schools and our workplaces optimally, we will be setting them up so that people can toggle the amount of stimulation that's coming at them at any given time. Because even for any one individual, you will see once you start paying attention to this that over the course of your day, you're going to desire varying levels of stimulation to feel at your best. But the gap is particularly wide between introverts and extroverts as to how much they need. You know, the problem, of course, is that we are not living in a world that is set up to make these kinds of adjustments and to grant and afford this kind of flexibility. We are instead living with this world that I told you about before called the new groupthink. So our schools and school days for our children increasingly look like this, where kids are sitting and they're asked to participate in one group assignment after another. Groups are fine to some extent when they're well managed, which they're often not. But when they're well managed, they're good. But to a certain extent, and then we need time for individual learning also. Our workplaces, more and more, are set up like this, open plan offices, where there is very little respite from the noise or the gaze or of your peers or freedom from interruption. And this is a problem. It's a problem, clearly it's a problem for the comfort level of individual introverts, but it's really a problem far beyond that, because we, of course, are living at a time where we care deeply about creativity and about innovation and fostering innovation. But it turns out that solitude is a crucial ingredient of creativity. And none of us, extroverts included, none of us are getting enough of it right now. You know, when psychologists look at who have been the most spectacularly creative people across a broad variety of fields, they almost always find people with serious streaks of introversion. These people, I'm talking about people like Charles Darwin and Dr. Seuss and Steve Wozniak, but the list goes on and on. These people were usually extroverted enough that they would go out and exchange ideas with other people. They could advance their own ideas, because those two are incredibly important ingredients of creativity. But they were introverted enough that they cherished solitude and they would go off and get as much of it as they could. This is a picture here of Philippe Starck, who's one of the great designers of our time. And if you read him describe his creative process, He talks about going off for months at a time every year. And during these months, he says, he doesn't attend a single party. He doesn't even read a magazine or watch TV, because he knows there is something magical about solitude and he doesn't want to be influenced by the thoughts and ideas of other people. So he preserves the solitude at all costs. Now, artists like Philippe Starck have always understood this by instinct, and this tradition of solitude being a transcendent state has until recently been it's been a kind of canonical idea in Western literature and in Western culture. But we've recently forgotten it, but interestingly, we're starting to reclaim it through psychology, because psychologists are now starting to understand just what it is that artists like Philippe Starck are craving so deeply. And I don't have time now to tell you all about the amazing research that's happening. A lot of it is in my book in Chapter 3 if you want to take a look. But I'm just going to give you a few highlights just to whet your appetite. The first thing is, one of the magical things that happens in solitude is the state of deliberate practice. How many of you have heard of something called the 10,000-hour rule? Okay, a lot of you. This is basically the idea that if you want to get to be really good at something, if you want to become a star in your field, an expert in your field, truly excellent, you have to spend roughly 10,000 hours practicing your skill, practicing your craft. And you have to do it in this state that's called deliberate practice, where you're really, really focused on all the time getting better, all the time improving. You're always focused on the piece of the puzzle that's kind of just out of your grasp, just within it, but just without it too. The thing that people don't talk about, though, with deliberate practice is that a lot of it has to be done in solitude. I spoke to Anders Ericsson, who's the psychologist who pioneered this entire field. He said, The problem with doing this stuff in groups is that with groups, you're frittering away too much of your time because too much of the group time is spent working on the pieces of the puzzle that other people need to work on or that other people find interesting, not the pieces that are interesting or challenging to you. So for every 10,000 hours of group time that you're putting in, you're not getting 10,000 for the buck. You're getting some small fraction of that. So it's the people who have the inner reserves to go off in solitude who actually reap the benefits. This is a picture of Jeremy Lin, the star basketball player. When he talks about his past, he repeatedly describes a process of drilling himself alone. You know, again and again and again, he would practice his moves. This is something that elite athletes often describe, even the ones like Jeremy Lin who are members of team sports. There's still always this solitary element. Now, the other thing that's so important about being able to go off by yourself is that you can then absent yourself from some of the pressures and the infelicities of group life. Turns out there have been more than 40 years of research on brainstorming, more than 40 years worth, decades after decades, and they always conclude that individuals brainstorming by themselves produce more ideas and better ideas than groups of people brainstorming together. So much so that you see this quote, "The evidence from science suggests businesses must be insane to keep using brainstorming groups the way they do." Now, they may not be totally insane because there is one great benefit to brainstorming as a group, and that is social cohesion. When people come together to work on an idea, their morale improves, they feel united behind the idea. Interestingly, they often believe that the idea was a better one than the one the individuals came up with, even when that's objectively not true. There's something about the group life that can be good for an organization. And that's wonderful as long as we understand what's happening, as long as we understand that that's what the value is, but that when we want to get people truly thinking deeply and truly thinking creatively, we need to send them off by themselves before they come together with a group. And then finally, the other real problem with group life is the problem of conformity, the problem of peer pressure. And even for those of us who believe that we are independent thinkers and that we are mavericks and iconoclasts and not subject to peer pressure, well, you know what? It turns out we're human, and all human beings have this kind of design flaw of being so porous to each other that we end up conforming more than we think we would. And this is one of the most robust findings in social psychology. And I want to give you just a taste of it. So I'm going to play you this clip dating back to the 1960s. That's how long this research has been going on. Oops. Wait a minute.
The Ash experiment is one of psychology's oldest and most popular pieces of research. A volunteer is told that he's taking part in a visual perception test. What he doesn't know is that the other participants are actors, and he's the only person taking part in the real test, which is actually about group conformity.
Please begin. The experiment you will be taking part in today involves the perception of line length. Your task will be simply to look at the line here on the left and indicate which of the three lines on the right is equal to it in length. So, for example, if you...
The actors have been told to match the wrong lines. The volunteer will be monitored to see if he gives the correct answer or if he goes along with the opinion of the group and gives the wrong answer. In the first test, the correct answer is 2.
One. Two.
One. Once again, the correct answer is 2.
Three.
Three.
Yeah, I know it seems unbelievable, and as if, you know, if you were in there, you wouldn't do this, but really, there's been... experiment after experiment has come up with these results. And I want to ask you a question. Solomon Ash, the psychologist who devised these experiments, he went to his grave wondering the answer to this question. When the person says 3 instead of 2, are they knowingly succumbing to peer pressure because they want the group to think well of them, but they honest to goodness know what the right answer is? Or have they honest to goodness come to believe that the correct answer is three? So let's take a poll. How many of you think that they know full well what the right answer is, and they're just going along with the group? Most of you, okay. And how many of you think that they have honest to goodness changed their minds about what is the right answer? Okay, a handful of you. Well, it's interesting. The handful of you seems to be right based on the most recent line of research, because you know what we can do now is variations of this same experiment, except we can stick the subject's head inside a brain scanner at the very moment that they're saying three instead of two. So we can get some glimpse of what's going on inside their heads at this moment. And I'm going to take you through one of these experiments. Before I go through this one, just a disclaimer for the ladies in the audience. I don't think this experiment was intended in any kind of sexist way, but it might strike you that way. And for the fellows in the audience, you might come across as a little bit dopey. So apologies, but it's worth it in the interest of science. This is an interesting study. Okay. The way this worked was they took a bunch of guys, and each guy sat by himself and was shown 180 photographs of women's faces, just like the kind you see here, in quick succession. He had, 8 seconds or so to look at each one. And for each face, he was asked to rate the woman's attractiveness on a scale of 1 to 7. So in this case, he's rated this woman a 4. And then before, a few seconds before the photograph switches to the next photo, he has the chance now to see how a group of his peers have rated this exact same woman. So in this case, his peers have rated her much higher. They've rated her a 6. So he sees this, and then he moves on to the next photo, and the photo after that, blah, 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 all through. Then about an hour later, he has the chance to look at all of the 180 photos again and to rate them. And just as we would have predicted based on the Saul Ash experiments, he is now much more likely to rate this same exact woman a 5 or a 6, so much higher than he first rated her himself. But remember, his head's inside a brain scanner. And so what we can see is that the second time he's looking at this woman's face, the reward networks, you know about reward networks, we talked about them earlier, the reward networks in his brain are now much more activated than they were the first time he looked at her, suggesting that he is on some deep, unmanipulable level experiencing this woman with more pleasure than he did, the sight of this woman with more pleasure than he did the first time around. And that is an amazing result when you think about it, because what it suggests to us is that we instinctively mimic other people's opinions, even about something as seemingly personal and visceral as who we're attracted to. We still pick up on the opinions of the people around us. And the crazy thing is that we don't even know that we're doing it. When you do these experiments and you ask people, have you changed your mind as a result of input? People are always convinced that this is not so, and that they've just independently come to this idea on their own. But that's not so. This is the result they come up with. Now, the problem then is, what do we do about all this? Because you have a bunch of people sitting in a group, and the best talkers don't necessarily have the best ideas. So what are we going to do? I'm just going to give you 3 concrete ideas of ways to take all of this out into your lives. And then what I want to do is open this up for Q&A, and we can talk about it further. So the first thing is just to stop the madness that we have in the society for constant group work. Just stop it. We don't have to have as many meetings as we do. Schools do not have to be organized the way they are around constant group work for the students. And when we do come together in meetings, when we do, there are processes we can follow to make it a more hybrid situation. So usually before you have a meeting of people, you know, the practice is to distribute an agenda, which people glance at for 20 seconds and then show up at the meeting. I would suggest a much more deliberate practice where people go off by themselves before the meeting, and it's part of their job and part of the social expectation that they're going to prepare for the meeting and really brainstorm by themselves and really think through the problem. And then you come together and then you share what you have thought about independently. And then you do the same thing halfway through the meeting. You kind of stop the meeting and go around the room and ask people to write down their ideas or reflect on their ideas, and then one by one ask people to share what they have come up with as a result of doing that. And you want to do it one by one because you want to make it so that people aren't jockeying for position and the loudest people getting the most airtime, but rather it's just a synchronized process. Okay, number two, to rethink leadership. We know from management research that extroverts are way more likely than introverts to be groomed, excuse me, for leadership roles. And yet we also know that in a variety of circumstances, introverted leaders deliver better outcomes than extroverts do. I mean, there are situations in which one style is better. There are situations in which other styles are better. And so we make a grave mistake to assume that the only natural leader, whatever that word natural is, that the only natural leader is the type of person who, when they were a child, was kind of easily organizing games in the classroom schoolyard. There's a lot of other different modes of leadership beyond that. And I would say to all of you, for the many introverts in the audience, you've probably seen this in your own lives, or you might be kind of sitting on the verge of taking a leadership position in the world that you are in a position to influence. And I think that it helps to choose role models from your own life of people who have done just this, but I'm also going to give you just a few. This is Larry Page and Marissa Mayer, CEOs, of course, of Google and of Yahoo. Silicon Valley is filled with quieter, more introverted people who have ascended to leadership positions. It's not an accident that this is so. This is a place where people tend to be rewarded by having a kind of passion for what they're doing and a real sense of good ideas, and people get behind that. This is Douglas Conant. He was the CEO until recently of Campbell Soup, much beloved figure. Describes himself as very shy and as very introverted. And he did what many introverts do, which is kind of learn to act more extroverted when they need to. But he also did what many effective introverts do, and that is he drew on his own natural strengths. So in his case, he had a practice of identifying the employees in the company who had been contributing in profound ways, and then sending them personal letters of thanks. Here you can see him writing just such a letter. And during his time at Campbell, he wrote 30,000 of these personal letters. 30,000, which is something really no extrovert would do. Like, what extrovert would want to sit down at his or her desk and churn out all those letters? An extrovert would find another equally effective way of connecting. But an introvert finds a way that works for him. And it doesn't really matter what the way is. All that matters is that you get there. Here are some pictures of some of the transformative leaders of the 20th century who I write about in my book. Eleanor Roosevelt, Gandhi, Rosa Parks. Every single one of these people was described as quiet, as shy, as soft-spoken. Every single one of them took the helm, even though every bone in their bodies was telling them not to. And that turns out to have a subtle power all its own, because people can feel when somebody is at the helm, not because they enjoy being looked at, quite the contrary, and not because they enjoy controlling events. They're there just because they have no choice, because they really care about the cause that's at hand, or the organization that's at hand, or the mission that's at hand, and people will line up behind that. And then finally, I would say we need to radically think what we mean by diversity. We know in this country, we know really well by now, the case for moral diversity, I'm sorry, for racial diversity and for gender diversity. And we know that these are moral issues, and we know beyond that that these are issues that affect the bottom line and that we all do better when we have a broader spectrum of people represented. And I would say to you that the same exact thing is true when it comes to personality diversity. The same thing is true. We desperately need the talents of the quiet thinkers among us. And the beauty of it is, it doesn't take a lot of time to make this happen, and it doesn't cost a lot of money. All it takes is thinking a little bit differently about what it means to be quiet. So, thank you very much for listening, and thank you. Thank you. Thank you. What I'm going to do now is, first of all, I put up here, if you'd like to stay connected around these issues, here's how to reach me through my blog, through Twitter, and through Facebook. And now I'm going to open this up to Q&A, and you should feel free, really, to ask me like any question. You might have a question about your children, about your spouses. It's all good. So let me see what time it is. Yeah, we've got time. All the way in the back. Yeah. I think it is taking away from our ability to find solitude, and I think this requires now as much discipline as dieting does, really, because it's the same, I think it's the same sense of addictive pleasure calling out to you when your cell phone is bleaking at you as when you see, you know, a piece of food that you want to eat. So yes, I think it calls for a lot of management. I do think at the same time that social media and our general connectedness gets a bad rap in general, and we tend to see it as kind of subjecting ourselves to a fire hose of information and overstimulation that's coming at us. But I do see that when it's properly managed, it can be an incredible boon, especially for introverts who now have the ability to communicate with hundreds or thousands of people without actually leaving their own homes. So it's very stimulating on the one hand, but it's also a lot less stimulating than standing up on a soapbox and trying to get people to listen to you. So I think it's a double-edged sword. Yes, all the questions are in the back. Wait, I'm sorry, was the question about quiet introverts, did you say?
No, about loud introverts.
Oh, about loud introverts. Yeah. You know, so introversion comes in a lot of... So the question is, what about loud introverts? Okay. So introversion comes in a lot of different flavors. And one distinction I should make off the bat is the difference between shy introverts and non-shy. So shyness is about the fear of social judgment, right? It's like you're going into a job interview or a date or that kind of thing, and you tend to be really unduly worried about what other people think of you. That's shyness. Introversion is purely about wanting to reduce the amount of stimulation coming at you. So for people who are not shy, they might be quiet, they might not be quiet, but they still are going to want to have this ability to kind of remove themselves from the greater hubbub of our society. The book is really, you know, it's about all these different kinds. It's about introverts who are loud and not shy, introverts who are quiet and not shy. It is also about shy people. It's been interesting. I've come to see through doing this book touring that possibly the word shy is even more stigmatized in this culture than the word introversion. And I think that we're really misunderstanding what shyness can be. Certainly extreme shyness is incredibly painful and disabling, really. I mean, it makes a life very difficult to live. But a small degree of shyness, I believe, is a civilizing force in a society that is otherwise going too much in the other direction. I mean, we know that we know among young people that rates of narcissism and self-centeredness are going way up, and rates of empathy are going way down. I mean, as in plummeting, like every year plummeting. And so, and shyness intrinsically is about having so much regard for other people that you're giving them the power to care what they think of you. So some degree of that is civilizing. Yes.
About introversion, is there a difference between what you talk about and cultural introversion?
Yeah. Is there a difference between this and cultural introversion? You know, when you talk about introversion, there's so many pieces to it. There's for many people, a biological piece, a genetic piece. For many people, a piece that's kind of what you will yourself to be at any given in any given situation. If you're sitting in church, you will yourself to act more introverted. If you're at a party, you're willing yourself to act more extroverted. And then there's the third piece that's cultural. And I write about this in the book. I have a whole chapter where I talk about the differences between Far Eastern cultures in particular and Western societies. And in Far Eastern cultures and many Asian societies, there's much more reverence for a person who is not talking so much. You know, the idea there is that words themselves are seen as dangerous weapons because words can hurt other people. Words can get the speaker into trouble. So the person who has more restraint, who has more social restraint, is seen as being strong. There's an Asian aphorism, the wind howls, but the mountain remains still. And these kinds of attitudes profoundly affect the way we conduct ourselves in day-to-day life, and they're very different. Yes. Is there a gender difference in being comfortable with and harnessing introversion? And this is a really tricky question. There is no gender difference, by the way, in terms of statistics. So most recent study found it's about 50-50. Men are introvert, extrovert, 50-50, same for women. But the way it gets expressed can be really different. So for women, I'll start with women. For women, there is still the lingering cultural stereotype of the woman who is shy and demure, and that being associated with a kind of mysterious allure. And so I've actually heard from women who are more loud and more extroverted, and they've said, well, what about us? Because we actually have problems of our own because we're kind of too loud, and people don't like that either. So women have this kind of two different roles that they're straddling. On the one hand, the shy and demure. On the other hand, they're expected to be the vivacious hostesses. Then on the other hand, they can't be too loud, so it gets all very complicated. For men, the issue men have, introverted men have, is this cultural precept that you're supposed to be the kind of dominant, take charge guy. Now, the culturally acceptable version of that is being the strong, silent type, which that too, just the way there's still this culturally acceptable echo of the shy, demure woman or the mysteriously alluring woman, same thing holds true for the kind of strong, silent type of men. So these cultural envelopes are incredibly complicated, and it sometimes seems as if getting through the day requires just sort of picking the envelope that suits you at any given moment. Yes. Yeah. Is there an instructional strategy that would balance group work for introverted students? Yeah, I mean, so first of all, when group work happens, I was alluding to this before, it needs to be managed much more carefully than I've seen it happening in many classrooms, which is to say the groups should be small, roles should be very strictly assigned, and everybody should really understand what their role is. And the groups should be carefully selected so that you have the right mix of students. Because I spent a year traveling through classrooms all over the country in private and public schools. And what I often saw was group work devolving into a kind of social Darwinism, where you basically just had the most dominant kid in whatever group taking over, and the other kids were just sitting passively by or uncomfortably by or chatting about what movie they were going to go to that weekend. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is we just don't need so much group work. So some group work is fine. You look very young. I'm 44. When I went to school, there actually was no such thing as group work. Like when I did this year of research that I'm telling you about, I was astonished to find how much kids were working in groups because I had never seen it before. So this is an educational fad. It's an educational trend that has just kind of gone haywire. It's run amok. So all I'm saying is we can dial it back quite a bit and still have plenty of group work and we'll all be better off. You know, the extroverted kids too, because remember what I was saying about deliberate practice and about how becoming really excellent at something requires going off by yourself. Well, It's actually, in some ways, the extroverted kids I worry about the most, because they're the ones who won't naturally be seeking out the solitude that they need to really develop their skills. The introverted kids will figure out a way to get the solitude by hook or by crook, but it's the extroverts who need to be taught it and encouraged. Yes? What do I have planned for my future? Oh my gosh. I say oh my gosh because I'm still trying to figure out how to get 46 hours into a single day. Because I have another book in the pipeline, but I also, and I'm not a fast writer, but I also want to spend probably the rest of my life working on the issues in this book, so it's going to be a kind of juggling act between those two things. And I should say, by the way, you know, this idea of a quiet revolution taking place in our schools, our workplaces, all beyond, this is clearly not the job for one person. So I want to say to each of you, please, like, to the extent that you find these ideas compelling or meaningful, please carry them with you and take them out into your own lives. I'm hearing all the time from people who are implementing this stuff in Fortune 500 corporations, in their schools, in their universities. So it's up to you guys. Yes?
What kind of pushback are you getting from extroverts?
What kind of pushback am I getting from extroverts? Oh my gosh, that must have been the elephant in the room question, judging by that laugh. You know, it's funny, I've gotten a little bit, but I think not that much, because I think and I hope that people understand where I'm coming from, and that it truly is not a message of down with extroverts, but rather it's a message of up with introverts. You know, and there's a profound difference between the two. I liken this quiet revolution to kind of where women were at the time of the 1950s or the 1960s, where they were just kind of poised on the brink of a big and dramatic change. And I think that there were some, I'm going to extend the analogy farther, I think there were some men at that time who were seeing it as, you know, we don't need men. But I think that most reasonable women weren't saying that. They were just saying we want an equal playing field and that's going to be better for everybody. So I think it's mostly been received in that spirit. Yes?
What causes introversion? Like, do you
get to
horoscope sign?
Yeah, so what causes introversion? Is it genetic? Is it astrological? Is it some other crazy thing? well, you know, it's interesting. It's actually among, or the most, I think it is, genetically heritable of personality traits. So that doesn't mean it always is for any one individual, but in general. And we actually know that you can see the predisposition to be introverted or extroverted. You can see it from the time that babies are days old. It's amazing. You know, I was talking to you about how reactive you are to stimulation. If you give babies sugar water to suck on within days of their birth, some babies will suck on the sugar water more vigorously than others will. And the babies who suck vigorously are more likely to be introverted because, of course, what they're doing is they are displaying their tendency to react to stimulation, all kinds of stimulation, including sugar water. So those same babies, when they get to be 2 years old, you stick them in a room full of toddlers they've never seen before, and they'll tend to stand back and just kind of check out the situation. They're not necessarily feeling shy at that moment, but they are feeling like, wow, there's a lot going on here. I've never seen any of these people before. I'm going to watch and figure it all out before I go forward. And that kind of continues throughout the lifespan. In the back, you had a question. Yeah, have I heard about HSPs, the highly sensitive person? And yes, not only have I heard about them, but I have an entire chapter of the book devoted to sensitivity and to Elaine Aaron, the psychologist who pioneered this concept. She's an amazing person, and what she did was truly groundbreaking. She pretty much took an existing area of psychology that had found that there was this population of people who tended to respond to situations kind of with more reactivity and more sensitivity. And until she came along, that population had been described in very limited and in very pejorative terms. They were actually, by the way, not referred to as sensitives at all. They were referred to as inhibiteds. That's how the medical literature termed them. And she came along and she knew there was much more to this group of people, and she started doing experiments. And And she found, as I'm sure many of you instinctively feel, this whole other constellation of traits, like people who tend to be sensitive are, they're more, in their orientation, they're more oriented towards philosophical concerns as opposed to hedonistic ones. They tend to be very responsive to nature and to beauty or to music or to some form of artistic pursuit. There's this whole avenue of medical literature that she opened up. Yes, and I think we have time for two more questions. Yeah. Yeah, have I looked at the practices in law school and medical school of putting people on the spot, and has anything come of that? You know, that's a tricky one. When it comes to law school, I used to be a lawyer myself, I think that there is some value, actually, to training students to do that, as difficult as it might be, just because the nature of the practice of law requires that kind of thinking on your feet. So I think in that context, it makes sense. In medicine, I have some concerns about the trends that medicine is taking, because it is very rightly identifying the problem of doctors not having enough bedside manner and trying to teach these skills in doctors. But I think it might be doing that sometimes in a ham-handed way. And so I hear about the interview process that sounds a little bit like a social beauty contest, the interview process for incoming medical students. And I happen to be the child of a really good doctor who was quite introverted. And I observed him every day. He would come home from his medical practice, and he would have dinner with the family, and then he would go upstairs and he would pore over medical journals, like sitting by himself studying, basically, for 3 hours a night or longer. And that's what made him a good doctor, because he was keeping up on the medical literature. You know, so it wasn't being a social butterfly that made him a good doctor. And he wasn't a social person in the conventional sense of that term, but his patients understood that he cared about them and responded to him that way. So, and I think, you know, somebody like my father in that medical school process, I don't really know how it would have worked out for him. And I think that that's a mistake. I mean, who knows who we're screening out? So I think it's something to really think through. And now we have time for one more question. I'm going to take it right at the front.
You're not an anthropologist. I lived in Sierra Leone, West Africa.
Yeah.
And I consider that country hugely extroverted. Mm-hmm. I have no personal space. And then I'm thinking about subcultures within society.
Yeah.
And maybe kind of like trades passing in the night or kind of clashes of value. And I don't know where I'm going with this, but it's kind of interesting to think about expressions and sensitivity. And there must be variation within each culture, I think,
yes,
of sensitive people in an extroverted culture.
Yeah. So this woman's saying she had the experience of living in Sierra Leone, which was an extremely extroverted culture. And she's also reflecting that here in the United States, and in any society really, that there are different subcultures going on and kind of pockets of people who are more on the introverted or sensitive side, pockets who are not. And I think that's right. And I think that we kind of instinctively find these pockets and kind of know where to find them. It's also interesting, yeah, you know, the United States does seem to be among the most extroverted of populations, and we know this from cross-cultural studies, but there are countries that are still more extroverted than we are. I guess Sierra Leone is one of them. I met a woman the other day who was from Spain, and she said, and she had recently moved here, and she said it was much harder for her in Spain than it was here. So there you are. It really is all relative. Okay, so I want to thank you so much for coming. I'm going to be signing books and would love to meet as many of you one-on-one as I can. Thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.